Accession number 29958, Reel 4.
I think that you know, the aspect of your story that we're hearing at the moment is one that I could hardly hope to have going on holiday myself. You're being paid to go on holiday and you're seeing all of this going on.
Yes, but of course, at the end of the line, of course, there is you've got to face up to the reality of life, in the fact that you've got to earn that holiday and you've got to do your duty by your country. And
you might be earning your holiday in the hardest possible way. You know, you're sacrificing your life for this holiday.
Yes, but that you say that, but of course you don't think negatively about losing your life. You smartly put that at the back of your mind if it ever crosses your mind about being killed. But yes, I agree with that, and I'm sure people at home were possibly more worried about losing their sons than the sons were possibly about losing their lives. They were looking forward to what was going to happen when they arrived in England.
In relation to the war, what were people in America talking about in relation to the war? What was the how had the war touched a place like New York?
Well, I think America was well and truly into the war in those days, because apart from the Japanese, they were helping Great Britain to an enormous extent with their ships, their
Lend-Lease
ships. And with their aircraft and other fighting warships and what have you, and they were very aware, because a lot of their servicemen were being sent across to Great Britain to serve over in that country, and possibly to invade. Europe, or invade France and Germany in the war. And so people were very, very aware, and that made them very, very interested in Australians or other servicemen who were travelling through their country, and they were so hospitable and so pleasant and interesting to talk to, and I think that they were those, of course, who had their sons in the services would be well aware of what we were going into ourselves, apart from what many hundreds of thousands of Americans eventually did to serve not only their country but to serve Great Britain and the British Empire in the fight against Nazism.
Mm. In relation to America, we see the sort of the Big Apple, the Carnegie Halls of this world. Mm. Presumably a bit of a culture shock for you, just let alone anything else, coming from a place like Perth.
Certainly. The fact, you know, I'd never been in
Empire State Buildings.
Oh, yes. Well, we travelled to the top of the Empire State Building. We just about did everything that these young ladies could to make our stay interesting, but the people were, you know, they were so friendly, and what I did find amazing was that their bars were open, dozens and dozens of bars around New York were open till 3 a.m. in the morning, and of course we'd virtually very rarely had been to a bar apart from our introduction in our early days in the Air Force, and to find so many bars around there, of course, was a bit of a trap if you weren't strong enough to resist them. And of course, not having too much money on me, I was compelled to wasn't tempted as much as I would have been maybe if I'd had more money. But you know, the volume of traffic in New York, and the even in those days there were still bright lights. They hadn't like in England where blackouts. They didn't know what a blackout was in New York, so that it was really a thrilling experience to have visited them. And of course, in later years, of course, I've been back there, and things have changed substantially. But I won't talk about that now because I haven't got to England yet. And some days after our three or four days stay in New York, we boarded the Queen Mary in New York in the harbour, and together with there'd be quite a lot of Australians, New Zealanders and Canadians. There were a very, very large number of American airmen and soldiers filled the Queen Mary, and we were in the down below decks in just bunks, really.
Below the waterline.
Below the waterline in bunks. I think the Americans got the priority, especially the officers, no doubt. And we were non-commissioned officers, so we were put down in the bowels of the ship.
How did the average American see Australian servicemen?
I think they were very fond. You know, we had something mutually going for us. I think we've always been on a very good basis with Americans. I think they were thought reasonably highly of us, as we thought of them. But that didn't greatly that didn't exercise my mind so much in those days, rather than subsequently when after the war, when I travelled and I found that the Americans are very, very fond of Australians. There are ugly Americans as well as there are ugly Australians when you're travelling, but I think generally we're very well received, and we've got quite an affection for them.
My impression is that Australian servicemen are often seen as something from another planet almost by the person in the street. They liked the way you spoke.
Oh yes.
They were taken by, they didn't know where Australia was.
That's right.
Never heard of you before. Yes. Are you white down there?
Yes. I must confess that was one thing I did notice, that Americans appeared to be fairly insular. They had very little knowledge, or they were gaining knowledge slowly, because the American Navy and their servicemen were serving down in the towards the Pacific area at that time, and so therefore they were getting. But they're fairly insular, as I think most people were back in the late 30s and early 40s. The same happened in England. There were some, as I'll mention later on when we get to England, I've got some stories to tell about what I thought of some of the residents there. They were some of the in the farming community, particularly in Essex, where I stayed. They had never been to London, something like 15 miles away from their village, and so therefore, they were. I think, generally speaking, in those days, people didn't travel as much. I think it's only in the days of modern vehicles and modern transport aircraft that people have started. Only in the last 30 or 40 years to travel extensively, whereas in those days, in the war days, I think people were very, very conservative and very they travelled very little, maybe because times were bad and money was short and they were quite happy in their own little villages, the same as I think they were in their own towns and cities of America and in Australia.
So here you are on the Queen Mary. Heading west, presumably.
heading, yes, we're heading northeast, yes, direct travel to Scotland.
People talk of the Germans in submarines up the Mississippi. So presumably there were some precautions being taken on the Queen Mary.
There's one thing about the Queen Mary is that she travelled at such speed that no U-boat would be able to draw a bead on Queen Mary, because they wouldn't be able to get a torpedo. They might get a torpedo off, but the ship travelled at such speeds, at high speeds, it had no escort whatsoever, right up through the Atlantic, we went up the west coast of England to Scotland, and there were no scares, mind you. We were all on board, I'm sure, were concerned and worried about the likelihood of us being attacked, because it could not only be from submarines, but it also could be of some German aircraft could very well fly over and try and bomb us, but that didn't happen. So, but there was always the concern, I'm sure, by a lot of the armed services on board the ship that there was a possibility that these things could happen.
Mm. What was the daily routine like on board the Queen Mary?
Well, you spent most of your day as in the Mariposa, apart from queuing up to go to the mess and eat, you would be called upon at a certain time to report to the dining room. But the trouble was that there were thousands of other people wanting to go at the same time, so you found yourself having to walk up to near the top deck and get on the queue, or the line, as the Americans say, and it might have taken you half an hour at least to get down into the dining room. And of course the meals, that's the first time I ever tasted dried egg powder. That was dished up as scrambled egg, and it's the most vile stuff you could ever eat. And so we didn't have a great we weren't delighted with the food on board the ship, but at other times, as we did in the Mariposa, we played, small groups of us played cards, and there was also some gambling going on, but I'd learnt my lesson about gambling, and I avoided it, although I must confess that I did lose a few pounds on board, because you had to sort of do mainly what the other fellows did, and most of them had a little gamble, and it was quite fun, as long as you didn't lose too much money.
What was the general atmosphere on board ship? Here you are getting closer to your destination, closer to the war.
Well, the only concern we had was getting there, of course, in one piece, and then, of course, you didn't know how long it was going to be before you would become directly involved as far as the war was concerned, and in fact as far as the bombing of Britain was concerned, and also you didn't know where you were going at that stage, until you got to Scotland, when you discovered that you would be travelling down by rail to Brighton, which was the main base for all Australian aircrew who arrived in England, and that's where they were put up in the Grand and the Grand Hotel. I can't think of the other one. I think the other one was where Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, was nearly killed in an explosion there in more recent years. Mm. But the Metropole, it was the Metropole and the Grand Hotels where we were stationed, and there we had quite a few air raid sirens. We had bombers coming over from Germany. They were going towards Portsmouth, being in a direct line over ports. But thankfully, we weren't. They obviously didn't know that we were stationed at Brighton, but I think they were mainly aiming for Portsmouth and the naval ports east, at least west of Brighton. And so, whilst we experienced a number of air raid warnings during our time there, the rest of the time we spent in marching and doing duties, drill duties, marching duties, and waiting for our posting. Eventually, hopefully, to aircraft, an aircraft posting.
What was it like to get to England?
Well, it was December, so you can imagine how cold it was in Scotland, and that's where we saw some more snow. After having seen it in America, we saw it in Scotland on the way down from. We went across to Edinburgh, and we got on the train down to London, and then down to Brighton. It was really most of our travel was done in the night time, so that we missed out on seeing a great deal, because I think maybe the troop trains were run at night and to make way for the normal travellers who travel during the daytime, and I think that's the reason we didn't see a great deal of Great Britain until we got to Brighton. But it was quite it was noticeable how much warmer it was in Brighton compared with the north of Scotland.
People talk of even if they were born in Australia, considering England home. Was there any sort of feeling on your part, here we are, finally, at home. Here we are.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm a royalist, and England, our forebears' family originally came from England, and I think they were subsequently exported to Ireland through some. I don't know the exact reason, but we had estates in Ireland, and that's where my father's family predecessors were. They travelled from Ireland to Australia, to the east coast of Australia, and so I'm being a great royalist and very fond of England as the mother country. We always thought it as the mother country, and we were part of the empire, and that's how it was. And we learned its history, and we were brought up to regard England as the mother country, and that's how it was. And I thoroughly enjoyed being there, not for the reason of the war, but really, but from actually being in the mother country.